Rents are in Portland, that's pretty low.
Okay, colleagues, good morning. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Thursday, February 16th. Thank you all for being here. This morning, the first thing on our agenda is we will be holding an informational hearing, which will be a presentation by the Oregon Youth Governor, who is part of the Youth and Government Program. And this morning's, the current youth governor is Erica Harrison from Sprague High School. And so I'd like to ask her to come forward and identify herself for the record and make her presentation. And I believe we might have some other youth and government students in the back there. Thank you all for being here.
Or Eastern Oregon students.
Oh, or Eastern Oregon students. Eastern Oregon. We like them too.
All right, Chair Smith Warner and members of the committee, I'm Erica Harrison. I'm a senior at Sprague High School. I've been lucky enough to be elected the youth governor this year. So first, I want to tell you about the Youth and Government Program, and then I'll discuss why this activity is so particularly impactful to its participants. So each year, high school students pair up with another student to sponsor a bill to be enacted by the Oregon State Government. This bill can be on any topic, and participants definitely take advantage of that, pursuing some sometimes outlandish subjects that they feel will make a positive impact on Oregonians. Throughout the year, students learn how to format and write measures, practice parliamentary procedure, and engage in intensive research on their chosen topic. Last year, my friend Kaylee, who wrote a bill to disallow public schools to ban books, could by the conference list off nearly every book that had ever been banned in Oregon from memory. All this effort is to present their bills here at the annual three-day conference in the Capitol building, where everyone hopes to pass their bill through their committee, the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, all of which are entirely student-run. The bill writing process is great in its own right, but I think the truly extraordinary thing about this program starts to happen when everyone comes together with their own ideas to discuss what they've written. Subjects range widely from politically topical issues to entirely new and fresh ideas that you would never have thought of before, but that actually make a lot of sense. I think you'll find it surprising the number of bills that are on entirely nonpartisan issues. Of course, there are bills to regulate wages or abortion or other political topics, but there are also bills on granting 17-year-olds who will be 18 by the general election the right to vote in the primary, which I hear was recently introduced on the actual legislative floor. And there's even a bill this year to allow Eastern Oregon to vote on whether or not they want to become their own state called New Idaho to increase their political representation. While some of these bills may seem impractical, each and every student is passionate about their ideas and has put months into researching their topic with their co-sponsor. Opportunity for outside-the-box measures and discussions makes youth and government truly enjoyable year after year, because you never know what ideals will come up and what kind of weird opinions people you thought you knew have. These out-of-the-ordinary discussions force students to consider their beliefs about politics beyond what they're already comfortable identifying with, and think critically about the relationships between government, society, and the individual. Here, students discover their own big-picture ideologies instead of just talking about a predetermined argument on whether or not they believe in a higher minimum wage. Youth and government grooms Oregonians who are actively engaged in political thought and who are ready to take on whatever challenges face our civilization in the future. In addition to expressing political ideas that are rarely discussed in the real government, this program also allows students to develop other skills that come with being an elected representative, like public speaking, trading yes votes on bills, and desperately telling everyone to support your bid for governor. In committee, everyone gets to discuss their own bills and talk about others, and here every student involved usually ends up speaking and becomes comfortable expressing themselves in front of others. Later, on the House and Senate floors, even the people who are usually quiet and reserved come alive during heated debates on whether to give citizens a tax credit for voting or introduce more rehabilitation programs in prisons. Speaking here gives students a newfound sense of confidence they wouldn't otherwise have, and it instills them with the belief that political opinions are still worth discussing, even during a time when many people think our politics are beyond saving. I've always been a people person, but even my limits were pushed when I had to introduce myself to complete strangers and ask them to support me when I ran for governor. After feeling awkward the first couple of times, I soon got into a rhythm with how to introduce myself in a friendly way and talk to people in such a way that would earn their vote. I can honestly say that since I was elected, I have not even been mildly nervous to engage with anyone, and this kind of character growth is common among nearly all participants. As our conference continues here in the Capitol over the course of the next 3 days, I encourage you to talk to some of the participants if you are interested in hearing their personal stories about what youth and government has done for them. Once you get them talking, you won't be disappointed, and I'm sure you'll hear some hilarious stories about interesting things previous delegates have said on the floor. Please take advantage of all the students here at the conference who can attest to this program's acumen if you are interested. I am sure any one of them would feel like the most special person in the whole world if they were pulled aside by a real senator or representative to talk about their bill. On Friday afternoon and Saturday, you're free to go sit in the House and Senate galleries and watch the debate for yourself and see what kinds of unique and insightful argumentation is happening at any given time. I will be either in the galleries myself or in the governor's ceremony office during that time, so you're welcome to come say hi to me and talk to me one-on-one if you would like. In addition, we are having a reception in the Senate lobby tonight at 5 where you have the opportunity to meet advisors and talk in more depth about the program. You will also have the opportunity to hear my wonderful voice again, as I will be speaking there about what youth and government means to me a little bit more personally. So I hope to see you all again later. And now I will take questions if you guys have any. Okay.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you very much. Oh, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you for coming. I was a teacher of advanced placement history and government at the high school level, and I also taught at the college level. I just introduced, in fact, today I'm introducing a resolution that you might be interested in, Senate Joint Resolution 2, which changes the rule that we currently have where you cannot register to vote closer than 20 days out. So if you haven't registered to vote by 20 days before the election, you don't get to vote. Problem that affects young people a lot because young people are more mobile than older people, and they often maybe change from one apartment to another, and then they want to vote and they find out, oh, it was 10 days ago that I had to register. Senate Joint Resolution 2 changes that to one day, so everybody could register to vote up to the day before an election, either a primary or a general election. The Student Association have been in and talked to me, and I introduced this bill at their request. And so I thought it might be something you'd be interested in as a young person that's trying to encourage people to vote.
Okay. I'm not sure there was a question there, but feel free to comment on that, or I'll move to the next one.
All right. Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe. I think that's a really cool idea and really good. I think there's a lot of reasons why young people don't vote, and one of them definitely is that it's like difficult to register on time or know when you're supposed to register, and there's just like a lot of paperwork that seems to go along with that that people maybe aren't so aware of, and then when they want to vote, they find that they didn't complete it on time. So I think that that's a pretty good idea, and I'm always open to things that encourage voter participation.
Okay. Senator Roblin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So who's your advisor at Sprague?
Chair Smith Warner, Senator Roblin. Our advisor, we have two advisors at Sprague right now. They're kind of transitioning over. So our old advisor was Philip Nickel. He teaches AP Art History and AP United States History. And we're sort of transitioning over to a new advisor. His name is Mr. Schuler. I don't know his first name. But yeah.
I just want to say it's really important to do the transition. I'm happy it's doing. From Sprague, I think he used to have Mike Montgomery for a long time, who served on the board of the YMCA Youth and Government Program, which I am a member of and have been for a long time. And I had the opportunity to be an advisor at my high school for about 20-some years. And there's a lot of people in this building who have gone through youth and government. And I think it's one of the best training, as you mentioned before. So Paul Evans used to be a governor of youth and government when he was in high school. And a number of other people who have gone on to help here. Mr. George, the younger George, Senator George, was a youth and government. I don't think he was governor. John DiLorenzo, that a lot of people know, was a youth governor of youth and government. And one of the founders of it back in the 1940s was a high school a teacher at Marshfield High School. So we haven't had a team for a long time, and I feel bad about that. Sprague has been pretty consistently there with a fairly large group, and I appreciate you being here today. Look forward to seeing you a little later, and I know there's a group that's going to meet with you at 5 today before you go on the floor. But great organization, great people, and having students have the opportunity, because I agree there's a lot of them that just sitting in their little committees, it's the first time they've spoken in front of people who they didn't know before. So it's a great opportunity. So thank you for being here.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I would just like to thank you very much. Thank you for appearing before us as the Education Subcommittee on Ways and Means. Even though we primarily work on budget issues, I think that it's a great example of experiential learning and how important immersing yourself in this process. And as somebody who spent a lot of time teaching adults about how the legislative and political processes work, I think it's even more important for you to kind of get that head start into being a more active and involved citizen. And here in Oregon in particular, where it is such an open process, and truly you have real opportunities beyond in the youth government to move that forward and go to your representatives and help get laws passed that will be actual public laws in addition. So I hope that you take the experience, all of you,
that you have here and stay engaged. And I'm sorry, but I believe Senator Roblin has one more question.
We should probably acknowledge there's a member out here of the board of directors of the Youth in Government, Amanda Dalton, that a lot of us know. And she also was a youth leadership person, Speaker of the House or... Youth governor. Oh, you were youth governor. That's right. So we've had a number of those people in the past, and it was I didn't see her. You were hidden there, and I thought it's nice to acknowledge those people that put their own personal time into making it better for kids.
Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. With that, good morning.
Good morning.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5509, the State Board of Licensed Social Workers. Today we'll be having an agency overview as well as public testimony, and we will begin with Randy Harnish, the executive director, accompanied by Anthony Medina from DAS.
Seems kind of microphone seems a little aggressive out there. Good morning, Co-Chairs Smith-Warner, and I see that Co-Chair Monroe has had to leave. Members of the committee, my name's Randy Harnish. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Licensed Social Workers. I wanted to take just a minute and describe what the board does and who we work with and why we exist and how we fit within the regulatory scheme of the health licensing boards. Our mission, it is really twofold. We establish standards for the professionals, the education, the experience, the criminal history background checks for those individuals who want to become licensed to practice as social workers. And then we also establish the standards for the profession. Ethical standards, just the general operational standards for those who are licensed practicing. It's interesting, I do presentations to the schools of social work every year, and it's commonly misunderstood, and our first order of business is always to describe that as a licensing board, a professional licensing board, we are not there to represent the profession. We are to represent the citizens of Oregon. We protect the citizens of Oregon. It's always a shock to these earnest young students to find out that their board's role is to really protect Oregon from them rather than to protect the profession. And so we have to distinguish between the Board of Licensed Social Workers, the Oregon Board of Licensed Social Workers, and the National Association of Social Workers, the national professional organization that does represent the profession. We have four license types, two mandatory licenses, and two voluntary licenses. The mandatory licenses are for those individuals who want to practice clinical social work. Clinical is a term of art that means an individual therapeutic relationship between the social worker and a client. Those clinical social workers tend to work in therapeutic settings, in a hospital or in a clinic or in private practice. The two license types is the licensed clinical social worker, which is the full independent professional license for a social worker. They have the authority to work in a therapeutic relationship unsupervised with clients. The other mandatory license is the clinical social work associate, the CSWA. That's really the on-ramp to the licensed clinical social worker. An individual can come out of a school of social work with a master's of social work, apply to our agency, we conduct a background check, we ensure that their license, that their education was obtained in an accredited school. We issue them this clinical social work associate status. They identify a independent social worker, an LCSW, to serve as their supervisor, and they work under the supervision of that clinical social worker for a period of between 2 and 5 years, during which they accrue experience, work experience hours, and one-on-one or one-to-small group supervision with their social worker. After they've accrued that, we allow them to sit for the national clinical social work exam. And if they pass that, if they're successful, then they can transition to the full clinical license. The non-clinical licenses are fairly new. They were actually established in 2009 and implemented in 2011. And they are the registered baccalaureate social worker and the licensed master's social worker. That designation allows the license holder to call themselves a social worker. Folks with that designation are not allowed to do independent or supervised clinical therapeutic work with clients. They tend to work in an educational setting or in an administrative or management setting in a clinic. And it's voluntary. They're not required to get that. But if they do get that license, they are allowed to call themselves a social worker. Our boards are established in statute. We're required to have 4 licensed social workers and 3 public members. A recent change to our board structure required, previously it was we had to have 4 licensed clinical social workers. With the adoption or the creation of those other license categories, the statute was amended to require us to have 1 board member that is a representative of one of those other 3 license types, the clinical social work associate, the master social worker, or the registered baccalaureate social worker. So 1 representing one of those 3 license types, 3 clinical social workers, and 3 public members. At this point in time, we have 2 vacancies in the public position. I won't say it's easy, nothing's easy, but it's less difficult to get social workers to step up and apply to serve on the board. It's difficult to find representatives to serve in that undesignated public status. So we have 2 vacancies. We have a line on someone, and I've got my fingers crossed that he's going to be approved sometime during this session. But we're still working with the folks in the governor's office to identify another public member.
And can I ask, how long have those vacancies been open?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, at least a year and a half. Mm.
A long time. Okay, thank you.
We have 6 positions: the executive director, a compliance specialist, an investigator, a program analyst who is our licensing manager, and then an office specialist 2 and an office specialist 1 that kind of run the operations of the licensing process. I was just curious yesterday when I was looking at this slide. I've been in the position for about 3.5 years. My compliance specialist has been there for 5 years. Our investigator has been there for a little over 2 years. Our licensing manager, the program analyst, has been there for 6 years. And our office specialist 2 has been there for 3 years. And the office specialist 1 has been there for 1 year. So at this point in time, knock on wood, we are fully staffed. I mentioned before our licensing kind of structure was modified in 2009. It required clinical social workers to obtain a license. Prior to that time, the clinical license was voluntary. So you could get the license and practice clinical social work if you chose to, but you weren't required to. To kind of modeled on a national statute framework that was established by the Association of Social Work Boards. The Oregon social workers moved to adopt or move towards a higher level of requirement that said that if someone is working in that kind of therapeutic relationship It's critical that they be licensed, that they have, they can ensure the public that they're working with, and that vulnerable public, that they've met educational educational requirements, that they have met experience requirements, and that they've undergone the criminal background check. It also added the voluntary licenses at that point in time, which was seen as a way to kind of broaden the profession and give those folks who may not be interested in working in the full clinical route a way to get a license to protect the title that they've earned by obtaining that that graduate and bachelor's degree. A number of licenses continues to grow, and we have two new Masters of Social Work programs that are in the accreditation process right now, one at Pacific University and one at George Fox University.
How new are they?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, they are currently in the accreditation process. So they've been accepting students for 2 years. The accreditation process is actually kind of interesting because you would assume that you would begin the process, complete the process, and then start accepting students. But the accrediting body actually requires you to put together a very rigorous application to even enter the candidacy. And then part of the accreditation process is to accept a cohort of students during that time, and then move those students through the process and then be evaluated by the accrediting body. And I know it's
sounds a little risky for the students, honestly, because what if they went through that and the school didn't get accredited and then they had a master's from a non-accredited university?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, that's exactly the question that the board had on that issue. We did an investigation nationally and found that the accrediting body does not issue the candidacy status until the program has been fully implemented. So it's the rare situation where a program is not fully accredited. Actually, it was explained to me that it's just as likely that a currently accredited school could lose accreditation as a candidacy program not complete it. So,
okay. Thank you.
I'll just mention social work schools in Oregon that are currently graduating students in the bachelor's degree. We have Concordia University, George Fox, Pacific, Portland State, the University of Portland, and Warner Pacific, which is also in candidacy. The master's programs is Portland State, and then the two that I mentioned, Pacific University and George Fox. Okay. I wanted to mention the key performance measures. We have four key performance measures: percentage of complaints decided within 6 months, continuing ed audits, best practices, and then customer rating. And I'm embarrassed because our performance measures on number one are abysmal. And we've seen that. Since I started with the board 3 years ago, we had a kind of a backlog, and it's as we have moved forward, we've tried to implement a variety of methods to address this. And you know, I'm sorry, I'm not jumping forward here. We kind of had a perfect storm in that we required social workers to be licensed. We added two new categories. We saw our numbers grow significantly. We had the legislature approved our first compliance position in 2011. We added a investigator in 2013. And our compliance manager went on maternity leave and was out of the office for 4 months. And we kind of created a bottleneck that we've not been able to dig ourselves out of. One of the things that we have done, we are fully staffed now, and we've begun to look at our internal processes with a little bit different eye. And the last bullet up there, we've revised our application review process. We were reviewing new applicants, and any new applicant that came to us with a criminal history of any type that was turned up by the background check, or any type of issue that was indicated through the self-disclosure statement on the application, was kind of detoured out of our application licensing process and included in our compliance process, which inflated our numbers even further. It's a reasonable thing to do given the license requirements. However, it made our problem even worse. So what we've done now is, with the board's direction, is to create a licensing application matrix, which looks at those criminal histories that may be for a minor issue from many years ago, and the board has delegated the ability to move those applications forward without bringing them to the board for formal approval. That has reduced the number that have to go through that more extensive process, and allowed us to process two things: process applications more quickly, and to begin to pull applications or compliance cases out of that stream. So we're beginning to see that take effect.
Representative Lively.
So I'm trying to understand, the complaints are from clients. Is that where the complaints come from?
Yes, Co-Chair Smith Warner and Representative Lively, yes.
So what happens in this period where you haven't met the 6 months or whatever it is? So are they continually communicated with that we're working on it, or they're just, I don't understand what goes on during that time?
Yes, there's communication that the case is being worked, and it's not going to be heard by the board for a period of time.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. What is the average time it takes to resolve a case?
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Representative Hernandez, it depends entirely on the complexity of the case. We have some cases that are, you know, that if they're a license application case, that can be resolved fairly quickly, within 6 months to a year. If they are a very complicated case that requires an additional, you know, a lot of investigation, that may take longer than that.
Follow up.
Sure. Follow up.
Do you track all of the complaints, how long they take, and then create measurements or data to show the averages of those complaints?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, I do. My compliance manager could put that information together for you if you'd like.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You started your presentation with the mission of the agency is to protect Oregonians, and I would say that Measure 1 is probably most centered towards that mission, and the data that I see in front of me shows that you aren't necessarily meeting that 85% target and therefore not in full compliance to your own mission.
Co-Chair Smith Warner and Representative Hernandez, I would agree with that. I will say, as part of our process, we utilize a triage, and as we get applications or get complaints that come in, those of a serious nature and those that would be an obstacle for someone obtaining a license, we prioritize those to the top of the list. It was an interesting conversation I had with my compliance manager a few months ago when we were looking at this. I thought we could meet this requirement if we addressed everything that came in and didn't triage and realized that our KPM is leading us to consider a response that really is bad policy. So we're in the process of evaluating those KPMs to revise them to actually create a measure that is useful, as opposed to a measure that leads us to consider things that really are not the right direction.
And maybe Representative Fernandez's suggestion about knowing the length of time that your complaint that could be part of that revision of the KPM. Senator Roblin?
Yeah, following up on that, do people get their license held or anything during that period? So, I mean, if it was a complaint that was pretty serious, do they actually have them watched, or do they remove their certificate, or is it nothing happens until final action is taken? That would be interesting to know.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Senator Roblin, it depends. If the board has the ability to act on and do an emergency suspension in the situation where a licensee has done something that's egregious and we need to take action very quickly. If it's a less severe or less of an offense, then the board usually waits to take action until the final action.
Follow up.
But if complaints are taking this long and a person is trying to change jobs, on the application there's probably a statement, are you under investigation? They would have to say yes to that during that period of time that the complaint would be out there. And I know that with TSBC that caused some real problems with teachers because of the length of time. They've kind of got that under control. This is a troubling one that we have to figure out how to help you or whatever. And just changing the KPM makes me nervous. I would rather we solve the problem before we change the KPM, personally.
Thank you. And also, do you have diversion for drug and alcohol addiction issues, as some of the other licensing agencies do? A program, if that's a complaint-driven diversion program that the licensees can work through and resolve their claim that way?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, we don't have a formal diversion program, but the board implements those as part of the settlement or agreement or the final order.
Okay. Go ahead. Good.
The other KPM that I just wanted to mention was the customer satisfaction. And our target is 98%, which is, pretty close to perfect, and our the survey that we get, we ask our licensees to complete, we get a very, very small number of responses. And so anytime you get two or three people who are unhappy, we've not met our the target for this one. We have KPM for this. Again, took place during a period of time when we were down on staff, and when you have six staff members and you lose one person for several months while you're in the process of filling the position, that's effectively a 17% reduction in staffing with one person gone. So we have the luxury of having good staff members now who are capable and are willing to double cover functions, but it does mean that sometimes things take longer than perhaps they should.
And I was also going to ask, do you have the ability in your staffing with the two office specialists, for example, to do some redirecting there to work on that complaint backlog? I realize they're not investigators, and that's a different thing, but the way you talked about how the numbers were bumping up, I just wondered if that's one of the ways you can deal with that.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, yes, it is. And in an upcoming slide, we have another issue that are hoping will help to address this.
Great. Okay, go ahead. Oh, sorry.
One last question on that one. You talk about percentages here. What are the numbers of complaints? So how many outstanding complaints are we talking about?
Because if it's a small number.
Okay. So you've got over 5,800 people. You've got 100 and some complaints. They just take a lot longer. That makes me a little less uptight because the total number does make a difference with regard to what we're doing. Percentages don't really give you a clear action of that. Thank you.
And Representative Lively?
Thank you, Co-Chair. So the customers are your license, the people you issue the license to. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Representative Lively, yes.
And so you made a comment about the small percentage you get back. I guess I'm trying to understand how you can change. I mean, if you're overseeing their licenses and that, but yet they're, I don't know, I guess I'm concerned about an agency in that is overseeing people and that they don't choose to participate in deciding whether the service is good or not. I don't know what the answer to that is, but if it's a small percentage, then sometimes that's not reflective of one thing or the other. So,
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Representative Lively, the survey that we issue or that we provide is upon renewal.
Okay.
And so it's up to the licensee as they go through the process whether or not to take the time to complete that survey. I suppose there are some things that we could do, but.
And it's probably worth looking into. I mean, even the language on, please help us, please help us work better for you. Please help your fellow social workers,
Right.
And I have no idea what your thing says, but it sounds like it would be worth it to investigate even, just any of that kind of marketing stuff that you can do to encourage a higher response rate. So, okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry. The last two having KPMs having to do with continuing education and our board best practices, we have no issues with those at this point. The number of licenses, as you can see, we've had continuing, if you look at the LCSW and the CSWA columns, we've had a lot, there's a continued growth in social workers who want to go to down the clinical practice route. Those numbers continue to grow. I was just pulling out some biennial growth rates, and in the CSWA category, we had an 18% growth rate in 11-13, a 6% growth rate in 13-15, and so far in 15-17, we have a 22% increase in licensees in the CSWA. Those folks will all hopefully move over into the full clinical social worker at some point. The numbers in the LMSW and the RBSW, the two voluntary categories, kind of stabilized, and now they're holding steady at about the numbers that we see. Most of those, the RBSWs, the baccalaureate social workers, get that license and then move into a master's program, and so they don't hold that license for very long. And the MSWs, the voluntary master social worker, many of those get that license and then decide to move into the into the clinical pathway. So we've seen our numbers continue to grow.
And can you just talk briefly about the difference in price between those four licenses?
Yes, actually. Let me just jump ahead here. The LCSW license, the initial license costs $460, which is a $150 application fee, a $50 background check, and $260 for their two-year initial license. And then renewal for the LCSW is $286. The CSWA is a $150 application fee, $50 background check, and $60 for a one-year initial license, and $66 for the one-year renewal. And the reason we do a one-year renewal for the CSWAs is because they complete their supervision plan at varying times, and so rather than require them to buy a two-year license that they only need for a year, we renew that license annually. The LMSW is a $50 application, a $50 background check, and $100 initial two-year license, and then $220 renewal for 2 years. And then the RBSW, the Baccalaureate Social Workers, is $50 initial application, $50 background check, and $50 for the initial two-year license, and $110 for a two-year renewal. Some of the things that we have done to kind of streamline our administrative processes is we now have online renewals, which has been an enormous time saver and cost saver. We do continuing ed requirements with a random audit at renewal. The three licenses, the clinical social work, LMSW, and RBSW licenses are valid for 2 years, so we only have to process renewals every other year rather than every year. We use secure iPads for board communication, and we are currently working with DAS and our IT contractor to allow a process that would permit us to do online licensure for both initial and renewal licenses. Our budget drivers, we're a fee-based other funded agency. Our revenues continue to grow with the number of licensees. Our costs continue to increase, and our current database limits our ability to automate services, which is, jumped ahead a little bit. We did implement a fee increase at the direction of the legislature in 1517. It was a 10% increase on just renewals. It did allow us to meet our to exceed our four month ending balance target, and it is appears to be sufficient to allow us to move through this next biennium without considering another fee increase.
Oh, Representative Hernandez? Are we appointing? Senator
Thank
Roblin.
Thank you. So, in looking at, how often does your board meet?
Representative Smith-Warner and Senator Roblin, we meet 10 times a year.
Okay. So that keeps you relatively current if some complaint gets ready to go to the current. I was worried you were a four-month, mm-hmm. once every 4 months. Okay.
No.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Senator Roblin, we have in the past and continue to meet in emergency meetings if we have to. So we've done that in the past.
Okay.
We do have a policy option package request for about $55,000, which will allow us to update our database. Our current database is woefully outdated. It does not allow us to do customized user inquiries. It does not allow us to do compliance record management, and it does not allow anything beyond the online payment for renewals. We are working with DAS and an IT provider that has established and is setting up a new database that's designed for small health regulatory boards. And this policy option package would fund the initial startup and then the first biennium maintenance expense for that. I think to Senator Roblin's initial or earlier question, we believe this database will allow us to offload some current paperwork management from our compliance staff and manage it online rather than have that an additional compliance staff workload issue. Knock on wood, I'm hoping that it works out that way. It appears to be designed to make that happen. And measures that we are following there are two bills out there that would require continuing education on suicide prevention and continuing education on pain management. That will have an effect on our budget. It doesn't appear to be a lot of increased time or cost, but we are following those. And I will say too, we are watching with interest. There seem to be a number of bills that would encourage or in some cases fund the use of social workers in schools, and we believe that our social workers are exactly the right type of individual and the type of profession and the type of experience that could serve in that function. So we're watching those with interest.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions before we move on to the DAS presentation? Okay, go ahead, Mr. Medina.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. And today I'll be going over the governor's recommended budget for the Board of Clinical Social Workers. One of the agency's emerging issues is their online and licensing database that Director Harnish just gave an overview for, and their investigative costs. The governor's budget supports current services and invests in the licensing database. Here's an expenditure history of the agency. And their expenditure is broken down by category.
Always our favorite slide.
Here's the agency's revenue history. You can see it. Not much of a Director Harnish referenced the fee increase that happened, that was approved in 15-17. The governor's budget supports current services and approves the database licensing policy package and makes adjustments for DAS price list and state government service charges. With that, I can answer any questions that the committee might have for me.
Colleagues, any questions? No. Senator Roblin.
This one I've had on all of them. Has the DAS, was there a percentage of the DAS price list increase? Was it a fairly substantial increase, or was it pretty consistent?
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Senator Roblin, it varies per agency.
Oh. Okay.
For licensed social workers, it in governor's budget, it went down by $9,000 compared to what it was at CSL from 15-17 to 17-19, it went up roughly 7,000.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Now, no one has signed up to testify, but is there anyone else here who would wish to testify on this bill? Okay. If not, thank you so much. Director, thank you, Mr. Medina.
Thank you.
And with that, I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 5509. Thank you so much. And I will call up Doug Wilson to finish our, to restart our informational hearing on the subcommittee overview information. Oh, yes.
Thank you.
And Mr. Wilson, are the materials on the first date of the committee meeting, the 6th, I believe it was?
Yes, it was the 6th.
I believe it is, and they've been updated. Insert that one slide, so hopefully our numbers...
Great. Will match.
Yes.
For the 6th.
That sounds right.
Caught up here to where we were. So we'll start that, or really on slide what I hope is 45 for you.
And it is.
I can count, thank goodness.
Yes, you did a good job.
Madam Chair, for the record, Doug Wilson, Leslie, fiscal staff. So this, we move into sort of this, the three or so categories what I have in the presentation for the education area right now. We'll start off with the state school fund. It is by far the largest item in your budget, as well as largest item in any budget in terms of general and lottery funds. It represents, in the past, the state school fund amount represents a little less than 40%, and in the current service level, it ranges, or it's hovering right there around $8 billion. So as you take a look at this graph, this just shows, which we have the state school fund, and then when you add the local components, the majority of which is property tax and timber tax, you have, for lack of better term, school formula resources. And we combine those and then put those through a formula that takes into account student count and various student characteristics. That formula is generally the area that the two revenue committees deal with, not Ways and Means. But of course, as always, Ways and Means has made changes to that formula for one matter or another around funding.
Representative Wisnant.
Sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, do you break out how much of the local share is property tax? Do we see that later, or is it?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I can, but I can tell you that property tax represents,
one,
I'm guessing, 95% of that pie, yeah, piece, but I can get you that amount.
Thank you.
And it will probably be.
Senator Thompson?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could go back into the 90s sometime and give us a number what the timber tax used to be revenue for that when we were cutting timber.
Yeah, I will, Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, I'll have to rely more on Senate or LRO on that, but we'll go back and check.
Thanks.
Senator Roblin, did you have something?
Yeah, I was just going to say you need to make sure that you go back far enough that we hadn't made the change,
yeah,
to reduce that.
Yeah, right. Pre-90.
Yeah, I think that's right.
In the 90s or 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
It was 1990 when Measure 5 passed.
What year?
1990.
Go ahead, Mr. Wilson.
So, Madam Chair, you can see that the general fund is by far the most of the total formula revenues. Lottery funds represent just under 4%. Keep in mind, the end of session bill, we always use the state school fund to balance sort of the use of lottery across state government, and the state school fund is the balancer for that. And a large portion of the lottery funds does go to the state school fund. You'll notice the common school fund is here. That does run through the state budget, and I was mistaken last time. It's a non-limited dollar in the ODE budget, but it is viewed as a local revenue for the formula. So that gives you an idea there of the state school fund. And you'll notice that the state share, the lottery and the general, and a very small portion of state timber tax, and please don't ask me too much about that, but it's a really small slice, represents just a little bit over two-thirds in the current service level of the formula revenues, while the local revenues represent roughly a third. Here is a little history over time, going back to the 03 period, of the balance between state and local. And keep in mind the graph I showed you last time I was in front of you, of the sort of changes in state shares, the early 90s there with Measure 5 showed a big change. Back before Measure 90, it used to be about 70% local, 30% state. It has now really reversed that over time as a result mainly of Measure 5 and the various ballot measures that came after Measure 5.
And so, Mr. Wilson, just briefly, when it was two-thirds or more local and less state, was that did the state use primarily general fund then for their part?
I believe so, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
So in terms of growing the state school fund, in terms of a current service level, what happens is we jump off the second year of the school year, we add the local resources in, We adjust for various compensation issues based on data submitted to ODE by the districts themselves around pay increases, which lag a couple years. The anticipated PERS rates for school districts statewide, those are factored into it. Various other mainly health benefit increases from the Oregon Education Benefits Board, or OEB. We use what percentages they give us and what they're estimating. And then we also have at least a small growth in ADM. It has been relatively small, about 0.42%. So it's less than 1% per year. And that's held pretty steady of, you know, not having a large student growth in the past number of years, given the demographics. And
Senator Roblin?
And sorry. It's nice to see the trends here and the amount of money, but because of differences in property tax, differences in taxes that come from federal government, each district is an isolated event, and the amount of money coming to each district from the school fund varies. Is that not true? They end up with a total of the same amount, but individually how that is by each school district is dependent on their other things. We have two school districts, for example, that don't get any state school funds.
I was just going to say that. You're right.
Madam Still Chair. Seaside. What's yeah. Jewel.
Jewel. Do you know what, which two they are?
I think Jewel's I'd have to go check.
Jewel's one, but I think there's another one.
Both out on the coast.
Yeah, I think the other one may be Cloverdale or one of those
and
others over there.
As part of the department's presentation to you, they'll go in much more depth.
Yeah.
And they have folks that know a lot more about the formula than I do.
And Representative Parrish?
Thank you. So I appreciate this slide. Do we happen to have somewhere, because I've never seen it, something that takes us back to, like, what would the trajectory of school funding look like had Measure 550 not passed? Because the interesting thing to me is, having gone to school before Measure 550 passed, teachers were striking because we didn't have enough money when property tax was paying schools and here in Oregon. So this has kind of always been a debate, but I'd actually like to see some data, if we have it, somewhere that said, had those not passed, where would we be, and would we still be short based on property taxes? Because ultimately you're still dealing with the issue of local options, communities that won't pass them or will pass them. And I keep hearing in some of these debates, well, you know, have Measure 550 not passed, but I don't know that I've actually ever seen data that supports we'd be better had they not passed, and that same balance of when local communities were paying actually would be generating enough given the PERS cost and the health care costs and all the other cost of public schools.
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, I'll look and talk to some folks who have been around longer than I have, but keep in mind there are so many other factors happening. I mean,
I get it.
And
but we keep
what,
hearing
what
it.
What would the state's priorities be with the use of general funds? Would they have backfilled if property taxes had lagged? But let me, I'll see if anyone's done any work on that, because
okay,
it does take a matter of a number of assumptions.
I appreciate that.
Senator Monroe?
Yeah, I'm one of those people that have been around longer than he has, and in the 80s there was great disparity in funding from one school district to another based on what the voters would approve. And in fact there were several districts, mostly in Southern Oregon, that where the voters would systematically refuse to pass any budget, and usually after about the third time they said no, the school would close. And so we had schools that were actually closing for lack of funding during the school year. I was chair of the Senate Revenue Committee, and I pushed through something called the school safety net measure. Got a lot of flack for that, but I wanted to keep schools open. What the safety net did was it said, after you try three times to pass a budget, you can levy the amount of dollars that you had the previous year with no growth. Now, a school district could operate on a school safety net for a couple of years, but because of inflation, basically the amount of money available would be gradually ratcheted down. That worked until 1990, when Measure 5 passed and this whole thing was changed. Whether school districts were better off under that system depends on the will of the voters in that particular district. in some districts, like the one where I was teaching, which is Tigard, the voters systematically passed budgets that were adequate, and the school district had sufficient funding, not overfunding. There were teacher union fights sometimes, because the teachers union always felt like the school board should ask for more from the voters, and the school board, of course, had to make a decision on how much the voters would accept. So it was a whole different system back in those days. Whether it was better or worse depended on which district you were in.
Thank you.
You know, if you happened to be in Curry County or someplace like that, you might have no public school at all because they would close them down for lack of funding.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. Representative Wisnett, and then we're going to hopefully give Doug the rest of the time to get through this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, less than 1% federal funds, and could all other local revenue, is that local option tax? And I've been away from this subcommittee for a couple of sessions. Is it still 5% except 10% for Ashland for the maximum of local option?
You're getting, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, you're getting to areas where I'm going to venture into.
We'll can get it later.
You may all, the department will be here starting a week from, or a little over a week from now. They may be better to talk to.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Keep in mind that this is, when we talk about the state school fund and state formula resources, this is not all the money that goes to the districts. In a little bit, I'll show you there's a whole other set of programs called grant and aid that flow to the districts, and that's where most of the federal funding is.
Title one, title
so
two.
Going on to this one, this just shows the change in ADM over time. The blue is the ADM roster, or R. That's just the count of students. The red are the added weights that happen for various reasons, which we go to the next page. You'll see sort of over time what the major weights are. There are a few other smaller weights, some of which are picked up in the yellow line, but your major ones are individual education program, IEP, which is basically special education. You'll see what's happening there with English as a second language. It has actually fallen a little bit, but some of that is just due to better counting, better reporting by districts. And you'll notice the green line, which is the poverty measure, that had gone up because of a change in law, I think 2 years ago in 2015, I may be off by a year, where they changed how that is calculated in the definitions. So I'll give you sort of an idea of what the other factors that go into the formula. This is here, and I use this as an example. This is total funding, federal, state, local, for elementary and secondary education. This is collected by the Census Bureau. I caution you, and I'm using this as an example, because I could go to another site and have a different ranking based on different measures. But I'm just showing you as an example of where Oregon sits. Now, don't take this out and say this is gospel or anything, because we can back it. We can go to another site on and take it. But it does sort of show. You'll find that states in the East, Connecticut, District of Columbia, some of those are relatively high. States that something like Alaska, which is rather diverse or has a very can't find the word right now, a sparse population, far apart, is relatively high. And you'll see that Oregon, Washington, and California are relatively close to the U.S. average, which is just a shade over 11,000 in 2014. Oregon was at just under 10,000, very close to where Washington is. So this gives you an idea of where Oregon ranks in one set of data. Move on to the Department of Education. I'm free. We can take questions too, man. I don't want to go through too quickly because we can start Monday morning off on this. It's already on the schedule.
We all seem knowledgeable enough right now.
Okay. So going into the Department of Education's budget, again, this is all current service level. Mm-hmm. The department in the budget system, the Department of Education includes the state school fund in it. We have taken the state school fund we just talked about, since it's the elephant in the room, and it is not included in these numbers. So Grant need for kindergarten through 12, and there's not all that money goes to districts. Some of it goes to ESDs, some go to nonprofits, but it generally serves K through 12 students. That represents about 29% of the ODE budget. Youth development grants represent just about 1%. The School for the Deaf, which is part of the budget, which does have its own faculty, it receives general fund and other funds. It receives about 1% of the general and lottery fund dollars. Early learning grant and aid, so this is Oregon Pre-K program, Healthy Families, the Preschool Promise programs, all of those represent about 27. That is relatively new to the department in terms of it came over in a reorganization a few biennia ago. Debt service, this is actually a growing amount because of a new program that just started that's in the current biennium for capital, the school capital matching program. That will grow. Meaning debt service, there is roughly about $125 million that were slated to go out the door this year. We'll get in more detail. I've included ballot measure 98 in this. It right now is a grant and aid for K through 12. Not sure how that will end up at the end of session, but I'm counting it here. And you see that it's a very large portion of the rest of ODE's budget. And finally, the operations and the staff for the entire budget other than the School for the Deaf represents 8%. And a lot of that 8% goes out to districts for assessments and other services also.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, we no longer have the books with the detail sheets. Are they online for the
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, they should be on. They'll be posted when we start ODE.
Okay, they're not there.
They're
now.
Not. We don't have them in hand based on the governor's.
They will
budget.
Be online.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I can provide some sheets over time as we move more toward work session that hopefully helps with the grant and aid portions of this budget.
Thank you,
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Does this budget, is that included in formulating the spending per pupil? I know that Measure 98 is for this current biennium coming up, but previous to that, that 2014 figure in the previous slide, the spending per pupil, did we use this expenditure as well to calculate that, or was it just the state school fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Hernandez, if you take Measure 98 out of this, this is all based on separate criteria than average daily membership or ADM or pupil count. This goes out based on a whole different. Some of it goes out as grants. Some of it goes out under federal law for special education, school lunch, and those kinds of things go out under separate formulas.
So to clarify, what I think you're asking is, though those numbers that you just chose from one source and might be different if we got them from some other source, that per student number, does that include ODE, this ODE money, or does that include only state school fund?
Madam Chair,
is that correct? Is that what you were trying to get to?
Representative Hernandez?
Yeah.
The chart I showed you on states, that should include everything.
Okay.
That's what I figured.
The only difference is I'm not sure about, like, the staffing in ODE, because mm-hmm. I think that's collected on district spending.
Right, and size of
it. Yeah.
Madam Chair, moving on, the next slide, which I guess I have to move. This is just the same breakdown in total funds. The previous slide was general and lottery funds. The grant and aid grows quite a bit, mainly because there's quite a bit of federal funding for nutrition programs, which are about $400 million. Special ed dollars that come from the feds, about $250 million. And the Title I dollars, the old No Child Left Behind, the new ESSA, that represents roughly $350 million. Those are almost exclusively distributed out to school districts, and in some cases, ESDs.
So,
Senator Roblin?
We don't see the Common School Fund money that's spent by the Department of State Lands in our budget, right? Even though it's coming out of the Common School Fund.
Madam Chair, Senator Roldan, what you see here, this $110 million in the 1 o'clock time slot, represents the investment earnings that this Department of State Lands provides to the Department of Education.
So it doesn't include that portion that they keep for themselves?
No, or any of their admin expenses, or that's in state lands. Then this, like I said before, the Common School Fund is actually a local revenue.
Right.
In terms of the formula itself, but it has to flow through this budget.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can see just the breakdown, very similar, or in the same categories, but not, it's dissimilar in terms of proportions. This is just a list of the major grant and aid programs. I won't go through them all, but you'll see what kinds of things are included in the various grant and aid programs. Just another sort of, to add a little reference for you, here's the graduation rate by cohort, and you think of a four-year cohort and a five-year cohort over time. Keep in mind that Oregon is not a stellar state in the graduation rate, but this does show it over time, and there's been some improvement over time. And then as a comparison, again, this is another source. This is it by state in 2016 for the four-year cohort by state. You'll notice that Oregon is in sort of the 70 to 79%, but it is relatively low in the rankings.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I should have asked before, but we talked about four-year and five-year, so we do count the 5 year as part of the total graduation rate when we calculate it?
Madam Chair, Representative Lively, it depends on what measure you're using. What you usually see, I believe, is the four-year.
So most of the data you're going to see is based on the four-year. Thank you. The five-year is something we've kept for a long time because we really do want to see the kids get through. And many of our school districts work really hard on that fifth-year program, try to get those kids back in school and finish up. So,
thanks.
Representative Fernandez.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Maybe you don't know the answer to this, but in other states, do they include the fifth-year cohort in their graduation rate?
Madam Chair, Representative Hernandez, again, it depends on which one, but the ones that are collected nationwide try to make that distinction so you're counting the same thing across states. Now, there are some real intricacies in that counting that does vary from state to state.
Yes, you'll find as we go through this, you will be surprised at some of the things that get counted in that rate and some of the things that don't get counted in that rate. It's quite odd.
Yeah.
Did you have something, Representative Parrish?
I was just going to say, a really good source for state-by-state comparison that's, you know, nonpartisan is if you go to, like, Governing Magazine, they have it broken out based on the four-year by state, and then they break out for kids with disability, they break out kids with low income, but it is based on that 4 year, and then you can go to another page on their site and then see what the per student funding is on in same average, like we just got our 99.45 that you just presented is also what they're using, so you can then compare per student funding against graduation rates, and it's, I feel, pretty neutral data.
Okay, thank you.
And it's probably coming from the same sources.
Learning Magazine.
Yeah.
Census, yep.
You should subscribe to that if you don't.
And finally, depending on what you want to do, this is just a sample of the issues for you that are going to be in front of you. PERS impact on school districts, no question there, it is significant. In terms of, as we calculated current service level, the increase in the PERS represented about $290 million of the increase. Not the largest share, but a significant share.
Doug,
that made the increase.
I'm sorry, to me that just begs the question, if it's not the largest share, do you know what was the largest share? Yeah, sorry.
Actually, if I remember right, it is probably employee compensation.
Okay.
Or employee salaries. But I'll check.
Salary as opposed to.
Not,
okay.
Not in total compensation.
We have to break it out. Yeah. Thank you.
Implementation of ballot measure 98. You've already seen a number of bills that are trying to divide and slice and dice 98. It is a major factor as we look at how to solve the budget problem. Keep in mind that's not just CTE. It is directed at three areas, high school graduation, college and career readiness, as well as accelerated learning or dual credit, and then there's also CTE. In some ways, those are, of course, all interrelated. Dual credit and accelerated learning, different strategies in that area for the transition between high school to community college and public universities and other post-secondary education. We need to be careful in terms of cuts around federal maintenance of efforts, mainly in the special education area. We're fine right now, but if you start cutting too much, you start running into maintenance of effort requirements for those federal programs. Education Professional Development, or Educator Advancement Council, this is a new initiative and one that you'll hear about next week from Lindsay Capps. There's been a work group working on that. They're still taking a look at that, but really to take a look at the professional development or continuing education and the preparation education for teachers and other educators. In the early learning area, early learning hubs, relatively new. Some work real well. Some work a little less than real well.
Amen.
And so I think that's something you take a look at. We've increased funding for the hubs over from the first biennium. So it's something that we'll take a look at. You've talked already a little bit about Preschool Promise, or what was originally sold as a mixed delivery quality preschool program. There's a number of issues there. It's a new program. The governor's budget does not expand it beyond its current sort of area of the state. It does add another year because it started halfway through, so there's significant roll-up in that. And then finally, there's increased federal child care requirements out there that does take some of our child care development block grant money and have to dedicate more of it to quality measures. These are quality measures and requirements that are coming down from the federal government and not necessarily the state in terms of child care quality. And so, Madam Chair, given it's 10 o'clock and it's another great breaking point, I will finish this on Monday morning.
Great. Senator Rowland.
So, Sensitive Chief Education Office, is that coming up soon during this biennium?
The sunset?
It says.
Did I have
one of the options?
Yeah, you skipped over it.
I don't read anything into that.
Okay.
Super successful program.
I didn't include it. I'm sorry.
Right.
I call this a sample.
Okay, gotcha.
It's definitely an issue.
I know.
since it sunsets at the end of
this biennium.
This coming biennium.
Right, that's right.
At the end of 19.
That's right.
So keep in mind, they will be in front of you next week.
Yeah.
In midweek, that will be the first education budget you hear.
Great. Anything else? With that, we'll close the hearing and see you all on Monday. As Doug mentioned, we'll continue that and then move on to our kind of big picture ed presentation work next week. So come prepared to listen.
You're going to be gone Monday?
I still do not know.
Okay.
We're making the final decision this evening.
Okay. Barbara, what did you think?
Okay.
We're making the final decision this evening.
Oh, okay.